Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Bid Information webcast. This webcast is for the Non-Solar Community Renewables RFP. My name is Benjamin Chi. I am with NERA Economic Consulting as the procurement administrator for this procurement event. Joining me and presenting is Dr. Chantal Lacasse, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA Economic Consulting. This procurement event is for the procurement of RECs from community non-solar renewable projects for the portfolio of Hamlin Illinois Company and Commonwealth Edison Company. You'll find the logos below on this cover slide, and we're going to use the short name of AIC or Hamlin Illinois throughout this presentation, and ComEd for Commonwealth Edison Company throughout this presentation. If you have any questions throughout this presentation on this webcast, please do locate the Q&A on the right side of your screen. Select all panelists in the Ask box, type in your question, and click Send to submit your questions. So that you know, the presentation as well as any Q&A that we provide on this call will be posted as FAQs on the procurement website. The website address is provided here at the bottom, ipa-energyrfp.com. Again, please ask your questions as the call progresses, and we will try to answer them as we can along the way. If not, we will pick them at the end. But the presentation materials, as well as the audio and the Q&A itself, will all be posted shortly after this webcast. So I'll start us off here with disclaimer. So this process itself is a process that has been approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission as filed by the Illinois Power Agency. So the governing documents will include the Future Energy Jobs Act, also known as Public Act 990906, which gave rise to this procurement. It will include also the IPA's initial long-term renewables resources procurement plan, as well as the commission order related to that initial long-term plan under docket number 170838. It will also include the REC contract that was posted, dated October 22nd, and the RFP rules that will be posted October 23rd. You as the bidder will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding these documents. So on this call, any statement that I make or that we make that describe or refer to governing documents or the contract, as well as the RFP, they are all summaries only, and they are qualified in their entirety by our reference to these documents. You can find all of these documents on our website. Again, the procurement website is ipa-energyrfp.com, and you can find them under the community non-solar community link. By way of the agenda, we will provide you a background of this procurement event, how it came about, and what are the governing laws or plan that gave rise to this procurement event. We'll provide an overview of what we are after, and then we will talk about the RFP process, the bid, post-bid process, and delve deeper into the transaction terms, by way of explaining the credit as well as the contractual terms of the standard contract, known as the REC contract. So, by way of background, this ILSFA pilot procurement is a procurement that has been provided in the law under 1-56 of the IPA Act, and has been described in the initial long-term renewable resources procurement plan, That plan provides for several procurements as well as open enrollment programs. That plan itself, initial long-term plan, was filed by the IPA in December of 2017 and has been approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission on April 3rd of 2018 under docket number 17-0838. That plan, also known as the initial long-term plan, has recently been updated as a draft and released for public comment by the IPA on August 15 of this year, and they have recently, in the early part of this week, released a revised plan. That plan is in accordance with the law, is to be updated every 2 years. So this is the first update pursuant to the law for the long-term plan. As I have said, the long-term plan itself includes the open information about open enrollment programs, such as the adjustable block program, as well as other sub-programs under the Illinois Solar for All program, and also competitive procurements, those that are competitively bid out, such as this particular non-solar community renewable generation board procurement. There are several competitive procurements that are envisaged under the long-term plan, and at this time, many of them have been completed, and ongoing, certainly, is this non-solar community renewables generation forward procurement, as well as a low-income community solar pilot procurement. On to the next slide here. Just so that you know where to find information, as I have said, we have the procurement website as ipa-energyrfp.com. What is important for you to note for this webcast and this procurement, this is for the Community Non-Solar Renewables Generation Program. If you go onto our website, ipa-energyrfp.com, just go to the left navigation bar, and you will see this link that is colored green in color, and that is the link related to this particular procurement. Within that, you'll find other sublinks that will lead you to the right documents under the final link tab. I should also note for you that there are several other websites that are managed by the IPA. We have the IPA website itself that provides for the long-term plan and the commission order, as well as links to other websites. They will, as I have said earlier, there are the open enrollment programs as well as the competitive procurements. For the procurements, for the competitive procurements, you go into the website that I just referenced earlier, the ipa-energyrfp.com site. But for the open enrollment programs, the adjustable block program website is at illinoisabp.com, and the Illinois Solar for All program, the website is illinoissfa.com, one word. So with the overview of the procurement program, just a few things to highlight here in a nutshell for you. The bid date is currently slated for December 13. This is to procure RECs from non-solar community renewable projects, and specifically non-solar PV. There are specific technologies in which we will explain what they are, and the requirements are really prescribed in the law what the eligible technologies are. A bid will be a bid for RECs from a project that you'll be proposing. You will have a price that you will name. This is not an administratively set price project or program where you will take the price, but you will name your price for what you want to get paid. And the RECs that are relevant and eligible for payment are those RECs that are delivered by you and that are attributable to subscribed shares of the project. The contract itself for winning projects will then be allocated to Ameren Illinois or ComEd. The target that we have set aside for this procurement event is 50,000 racks to be delivered annually from these community projects. In terms of the project requirements, as I have said earlier, some of these items here that you see on slide 10, they are really prescribed in the law, and we do not have any discretion over them. The projects must be powered by wind, biodiesel, crops, and untreated and unadulterated organic waste biomass or tree waste, and in particular, very specifically, solar photovoltaic, they are not allowed and is not considered an eligible resource for purposes of this community renewable procurement event. There's going to be a size cap for these community projects. You cannot build a project that is greater than 2 megawatts or 2,000 kilowatts. This is AC rating. The project itself must be located in Illinois and interconnected at a distribution level. It must be at the distribution level of an electric utility, muni utility, a public utility, or an electric co-op, as these terms are defined in the law. You must have subscribers subscribing to shares of the project, and you must be able to credit the value of electricity generated to these subscribers via net metering. We're looking for new projects, and what it means is that the date at which operation starts for these projects cannot be before June 1st of 2017. If you have a project that has already started operation and the date at which it has started operation occurred before June 1st, 2017, then for us it is no longer considered new and your project will not be eligible to be submitted as a proposal. But to be very clear, we're not after your project, we are after the RECs from your project. And once you sign the contract, assuming that you're a winning supplier and you have not built your facility, then take note that the REC contract itself allows for both a development phase and a delivery of RECs phase. And the project is expected to be energized within 18 months after contract execution, with some extensions that may be granted under certain circumstances. Again, as I have said, we're not after your project. There are project requirements, but we are really after your RECs. The RECs that we are after are standard RECs, which means that they must include all of the environmental attributes and be comply with the definition of what a renewable energy credit is under the law. It must be from a project that is selected through this RFP. You must register your project with GATS or MRATS. You must not only do that, you must also, as I will explain, set up a standing order within the tracking registry so that your RECs may be transferred to the buyer's account, either ComEd's account or EIC's account in an unretired state, and they must comply with all of the requirements of the applicable program. There is going to be a two-part proposal process in this RFP. This is mainly an online process. I'll talk about the part one process first. The part one proposal process will take place within the part one window that is starting October 24th and will conclude on a part one date, which is noon Central Prevailing Time on November 6th. The first step for you is really to request for an online application account. And after that point, the form or the portal will provide for you an online part one form to complete information as well as to upload what we call inserts. Inserts are basically some standalone documents that you can find on our website. Some of them are certifications, where you will basically need to download them, complete them, print them, sign them, scan them, and then upload that back into the online portal. The online portal itself will also allow you to upload any other required supporting documents. The only thing that is not done online in this part one process is for you to provide us your bid participation fee, and that gets sent directly to the IPA. The part two process occurs after part one has concluded and you are qualified as a bidder. The part two process will begin November 20th and it will end on a part two date, which is noon Central Prevailing Time on December 4th. It works and operates similarly. It's an online process. You use the online portal to fill out information as well as upload inserts. The only thing that is not done online is for you to send your bid assurance collateral in the form of cash or a letter of credit to the company. So send directly to Ameren Illinois Company and directly to ComEd. In terms of bids and bid submission, I will say a few things here. First is that bids are going to be submitted using an Excel spreadsheet. This spreadsheet will be provided by us to you when you qualify. And second thing to note is that you're going to use a secure interface, a secure file transfer interface to send us your spreadsheet, to transfer your spreadsheet to us. We will set aside some time to provide you to practice all aspects of filling out the form as well as submitting your spreadsheet to us through the secure interface. Once we have received your bids, all we're going to do is to evaluate your bids, and the way it works is that we will have a benchmark that has, at that point, will have been developed in consultation with the procurement monitor and approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission for use. And this will be a benchmark that is on a confidential basis. And for bid evaluation, only bids that meet or meet the benchmark will be considered, and evaluation will be on a price-only basis. For the fees associated with your participation, there are two fees. I will cover the first here. The first type of fee is known as a bid participation fee. This is a fee that is required per bidder. You only need to submit this once. For any of the procurements in 2019, if you have paid this before in a prior event, you don't need to do so again. If you're participating in, for example, the Illinois Solar for All pilot procurement, if you have paid that there or will be paying it through that process, you don't need to pay it here. It's only collected once in 2019 calendar year. If you are participating as a new bidder, this is the first time you're doing it, then it is a single fee, $500 is the requirement, that will cover your participation for all projects. And the fee is due to the IPA directly by noon on the part one date. There are two methods to pay the fee, either by e-check or a paper check, payable to the Illinois Power Agency. We ask that you submit us a request for a complete set of instructions via the email provided here, illinois-rfp@mira.com, if you're interested. In terms of the second type of fees, we also have what we call supplier fees. Supplier fees are different from bid participation fees in that supplier fees are paid only by bidders that have won in the procurement event, meaning that you have winning projects. If you do not win in the procurement event, you are not obligated to pay the supplier fee. Together with the bid participation fee, the supplier fees will help cover the cost for the administration of this procurement event. This is due to the IPA within 7 business days of the commission approval of the results. The estimate of the supplier fees at this time is $24 per kilowatt of the project's proposed nameplate capacity. This is an AC rating that we're after. again, is $24 per kilowatt of your proposed project. This is an estimate only, and the final supplier fee will be announced no later than 2 days prior to the bid date itself, which may be substantially different from this number that I'm providing. So with that, I will now turn the time over to Ms. Katie Olandi. Katie?
Great, thanks, Benjamin. So I'm going to start off this next section with the calendar, and then I'll go through some of the requirements for qualifying your projects through the proposal process. So the RFP process is going to kick off tomorrow with the opening of the Part 1 window, and then it's going to wrap up mid-December. So the first step is to submit that Part 1 proposal, and you're going to do that during the Part 1 window and no later than 12 p.m. on the Part 1 date, which is Wednesday, November 6th. So at that time, you'll submit by noon, and if you do have information that's missing, you'll be given, you know, additional time to cure deficiencies and complete your proposal. And then by November 19th, you'll be notified whether each of your projects have qualified through the Part 1 process. And if you qualify, then the project will be able to submit a Part 2 proposal, and you'll do that between November 20th through December 4th. And again, you'll need to submit your Part 2 proposal by 12 p.m. on December 4th. And the Part 2 proposal is going to include posting of bid assurance collateral in the form of a letter of credit or cash with both of the companies. And we'll go into more detail on that further in the presentation. And again, if you submit your Part 2 proposal and there's some missing information, you will be given additional time to cure any issues with your application. So after that, you'll submit your bids on the bid date, which is December 13th. And 2 days later, both the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor will submit separate reports on the results to the commission. And then the commission is expected to decide whether to accept the results 2 days later on December 19th. So all applicants who have not done so yet should register for an account or for multiple accounts if you're submitting multiple projects. You need an account in order to access the online qualification forms where you'll be submitting your materials to us. So you can register for an account through our website, ipa-energyrfp.com. You can see the screenshot here for how to do that. Or you can email us at illinois-rfp@nera.com and provide all the information we request here in the blue box. So we need a company name, the full name of a contact, phone number, and alternate numbers available, an email address, you know, an indication that you need accounts to participate in this non-solar community renewables RFP, and also the number of projects you're presenting so we know how many accounts to provide. So we're going to issue you separate accounts for each of your projects, and that's because you're going to be completing a separate proposal for each project. So at this time, if you have requested login credentials, you should have received an account from us, and it would have been sent to a single individual at your company. If you're planning to present multiple projects, whether or not you've already requested an account, you should go ahead and email us now at illinois-rfp@nera.com with the number of projects that you're going to be presenting. That way we can get back to you with additional accounts so that each project will have its own account. And further along in the process, if you do have an additional project after, you know, you've made your initial request for accounts, please don't delay in requesting additional accounts from us. You can expect that it can take up to one business day for us to turn around login credentials to you. So on this slide, we provide you a screenshot of what the online qualification form is going to look like once you've logged in. And we really want to note for here for you that as you're working through the form, you're going to be able to tell which account you're currently signed in as by checking the floating toolbar that we have on the right-hand side of the screen. You'll be able to see that what username you're currently logged in as, and also a note here that you can use this sidebar to save your work and log out and then log back in and continue at a later time. You don't have to do the entire form in one session. So this slide has just some general information on the Part 1 proposal before we go into the specific requirements. So first, for purposes of your proposal, a bidder is the entity that submits the proposal, and the seller is the entity that's going to sign the REC contract if the project is selected. And so these entities are not required to be the same. And I'm going to go through a slide. It's actually the next slide that provides a little more information on naming these two entities. So the Part 1 proposal, it consists of information that you submit through the online form. So you'll scroll through and type into fields. You'll be uploading supporting documents. And then you'll also be uploading inserts. And these inserts are documents that we provide to you. They're in Word format, and you'll need to fill them out and in some cases have them signed, and then you'll just scan and upload them to the form. So these inserts that I'm referring to, they're going to be posted to the website on the final materials section of the website, and they'll be in a single zip file for you to download before you start working on the form. So for bidders that are presenting multiple projects, I just want to note that information that will be common across all projects will only be required to be uploaded once. So as you work through the form, you'll see that some sections are going to ask you if you've already provided this information for another project, and you'll be able to check yes. In that case, you won't be asked to provide the same information again. So as I mentioned on the previous slide, the seller is the signatory to the REC contract, and the bidder is the entity that's submitting the proposal. So this slide provides some examples for naming these entities. So in the first example here, if you're presenting a single project, we would expect it to be likely that it's the same entity that's the bidder and the seller. However, that's not a requirement. And then we have two examples here of when you're presenting multiple projects with multiple sellers. So in the bottom box here, there's three sellers, and the bidder is the parent entity. So you'd fill out the forms, you'd put the parent as the bidder in each of the proposals, and then you'd put the separate sellers as applicable to the project. The other example of how they could be named is in box two here, where each proposal, each project has a different seller, seller C, seller D, but in both forms, the bidder is provided as a list. So the bidder would be provided as seller C, comma, seller D. So once you begin filling in your online form, you're gonna start with the contact information section. You're going to be asked to provide contact information for the bidder and for the seller, so you want to be sure to provide the exact legal name and also the address for both of these entities. You're going to also need to name an officer of the seller. This is the individual who's going to make all of the certifications required throughout the Part 1 and the Part 2 proposal for the seller. So this has to be an individual that's empowered to undertake contracts and bind the seller. And lastly, you're going to provide contact information for up to four representatives. And these representatives serve as the main points of contact, and they're going to receive all correspondence from us. That means they should be authorized to act on behalf of the bidder and the seller. So you'll be providing contact information within the online form for one representative, and then you can name an additional three by providing one of the inserts I referred to. This one is called the representative insert. So you download that insert, fill it out, scan it, and upload it to the form. A note here that if you are presenting multiple projects, then all representatives must be the same across all of your projects. So with that, I'm going to pass the presentation over to Chantal Lacoste, who's going to continue with the proposal requirements.
Thank you, Katie. Good afternoon, everyone. On the next few slides, I'll give a little bit more information on the requirements for the Part 1 proposal for the seller and then for the project. With respect to the sellers, there are a couple of different situations depending on whether the seller is already an approved vendor under the adjustable block program. If that's the case, there are a few requirements to fulfill. But what is true is that all sellers, whether they're approved vendors or not, and you certainly don't need to be an approved vendor to participate in this procurement event. So regardless of that status, then you would be submitting two documents, IRS Form W-9, as well as a statement of good standing from the Illinois Secretary of State. If you're already an approved vendor under the adjustable block program, then the only additional requirement in terms of documents with regards to the seller is evidence of that approved vendor status with the adjustable block program. If you're not an approved vendor under the adjustable block program, then you will be providing the date at which the vendor was formed, as well as the state where the vendor was formed, information about the ownership structure, including parent companies, affiliates, and sister companies, subsidiaries, et cetera. You will be providing the PGM GAS and or AMRIS accounts through which you would be transferring the RECs under the REC contract. And then you will be providing any exceptions that you have to the regulatory and legal requirements. So those requirements are not listed in these slides. They are provided in the RFP rules. They'll also be provided in an insert to one of those forms that you will download separately in Word format. And for any statement that is not true of the seller, you will then provide an explanation, which in this case we're calling an exception. With respect to the project, there's a number of pieces of information to provide within the Part 1 proposal. First, a general description of the project site, including the name of the electric utility, municipal utility, public utility, or electric cooperative to which the project is currently or will be interconnected if it's not yet in operation. You'll be asked to provide a complete address for the project site and a map for the project site, and that map should clearly show the location of the project within the site. You'll also be providing the name for the project, and that name will follow you through the entire proposal process. You will be providing the size of the project and kilowatts AC rating, and a reminder that that size cannot exceed 2,000 kilowatts. You will be providing the technology that's applicable to your project among the technologies that are allowable under this procurement process. For purposes of calculating the expected output under the REC contract, there's a standard capacity factor that's applied for wind. That standard capacity factor is 45%. If you're presenting a project in one of those other allowable technology, then you will be asked to provide data, studies, et cetera, documents to support a capacity factor that you will name. You will also be asked to provide the date of first operation, the actual date of first operation if your project is already operational, or the expected date of first operation. Given that there is a size limitation on each of the projects of 2 megawatts, there are additional requirements if there are projects that are co-located, community renewable generation projects that are co-located. So you will be asked whether that is the case for you and to provide additional information regarding those projects including indicating the location of the project within the map of the project site that you will have provided under your project description, and provide the sizes, again, in kilowatts AC rating for all such co-located projects. And depending on the information that you submit here, we may require additional information for this co-location. In terms of additional project information, that's another one of these circumstances where the exact requirements of the information that you should be providing is going to depend on the particular circumstances of the project. If the project is already operating, then you will be providing the PG&E EIS GAT or AMRIT ID for the project, as well as the fully executed interconnection agreement. If the project is not yet operating, there's a couple of different circumstances. If you do already have the fully executed interconnection agreement, then you can provide it and that will be sufficient. If you do not have a fully executed interconnection agreement, then you will be providing a number of additional documents to show the same level of project maturity. So you will be first providing a copy of your submission of the interconnection application. Second, a list of non-ministerial permits that are required for the project. And you will state whether those permits are currently in hand. And just to note here that in this situation, so when the project is not yet operating and you do not have a fully executed interconnection agreement, in the part one, you will be asked for this list of non-ministerial permits. In the part two proposal, you will be asked for evidence that you have submitted your application for those permits. So that evidence is not asked for the part one, but just a reminder and a note that it will be required at a later point in the proposal submission process. You will also be describing how the project is expected to be financed and providing letters of intent from lenders or equity partners to cover 30% of the project financing. And finally, you will be providing documentation for site control for an area in acres of at least 0.003 times the project size in AC rating. And that applies specifically to wind, and the requirements are a little bit different for other technologies, as is noted in the RFP rules. A little bit of a note on the site control documentation required in case that you do fall under those requirements, having a project that's not yet operating and where you don't have the fully executed interconnection agreement. In that case, we name a number of documents that are acceptable to show site control, and the list that is here is not an all-inclusive list. So we will certainly review any site control documentation that you provide that's not listed here. These are just examples of the types of documents that would be acceptable, including a signed lease agreement, proof of land ownership, of course, memorandum of understanding with the landowner, or a letter of intent to lease the land. Those documents, whatever type they may be, should provide certain piece of information to show the consistency of the documents you provide with the map of the project site that you will have provided previously. And that includes referring to the parcel or portion of the project site as described in the map, to provide the number of acres, so the area controlled by the landowner and to which you have the right under whatever agreement you have with the landowner, and to make sure that the document are naming the seller, an affiliated company, or some entity that's otherwise named in the proposal. In the Part 1 proposal, the seller will also be making a number of certifications. Some certifications are regarding the project, and some certifications are regarding the seller. The full list is provided in the RFP rules, but to provide some examples regarding the project, it would be, for example, that the project is located in Illinois, that the project is new, that the project credits or will credit the value of the electricity generated to the subscriber, et cetera. Regarding the seller, there's going to be a number of certifications here as well, including that the seller understands and accepts the terms of the REC contract, that the seller understands that there's no substitution possible of projects once the project has been selected and approved by the commission, and that the seller has title to the RECs from the project to be able to transfer them through the REC contract. Finally, there is a requirement, as was mentioned earlier, to pay a bid participation fee of $500 for those bidders that have not already paid this fee in 2019. Lastly, there is an option to provide comments on the letters of credit. So for the letters of credit, there are two types of letters of credit. There's a letter of credit that is appended as an exhibit to the REC contract. So that's the letter of credit that you could use during the supply period to post performance assurance. There's also a letter of credit that's on a pre-bid basis that you can use to post bid assurance collateral. And for either of those types of letters of credit, and for the letter of credit to provide bid assurance collateral on a pre-bid basis, those letters of credit are different depending on the company, so AIC or ComEd. So you have the ability to provide comments or propose modifications, and these would be modifications that your bank or your financial institution requires to be able to issue the letter of credit. But to the extent that you are intending to use a letter of credit either in the supply period or on a pre-bid basis to submit the assurance collateral, then you have an opportunity here to make sure that your bank is able to issue the letter of credit by being able to submit any modification that your bank or financial institution would need from the standard forms to be able to issue those letters of credit. There are some modifications that through prior procurement events, the companies have already accepted as being acceptable and that can be adopted on an optional basis. And that list of acceptable modification is going to be posted to the procurement website. Well, that finishes our overview of the requirements themselves. I'm going to talk a little bit about the actual process, so how it's going to work on a practical basis. As Katie was mentioning, you're going to be filling out fields in the online Part 1 form to submit the information that's required for the Part 1 proposal and uploading documents and inserts. When you have completed that process for a project, so it doesn't have to be for all your projects if you're submitting multiple projects. So for a particular project, then you can click the submit button in the online Part 1 form. And what that does is it starts the process of review by the procurement administrator team of your Part 1 proposal. At that point, we'll be locking you out of that particular account. So again, if you have multiple projects, you can continue working on the Part 1 proposals for other projects, but for that particular project where you've just hit the submit button, you're going to be locked out of that account while we evaluate the information that you have provided. We'll be evaluating the information you have provided and either giving you a notice that you have submitted all information that was required and you do not have any questions regarding the information that you provided, or we're going to be pointing out where maybe there's some information that's missing or information that doesn't respond to the requirements that are set out in the Part 1 proposal. And in that case, we'll be issuing a deficiency notice. That's any incomplete or missing information is called a deficiency here. If you are issued a deficiency notice, then generally you will have until the Part 1 date or 2 business days, whichever is later from the time of the notice, to respond to a first request for additional information. You will be notified on November 19th whether or not the project that you've presented has been successful on the Part 1 proposal and therefore has qualified to submit a Part 2 proposal. That correspondence from us is called the Part 1 notification, and in addition to just having the Part 1 notification letter letting you know whether or not the project has qualified, if it has qualified, the Part 1 notification will provide some documents that are really essential to your continued participation in the RFP. And that includes a customized bid form that not only you will use on the bid date to submit your bids through a secure, by transferring through a secure bid transfer site, but you will also use that for practicing the bid submission procedure during a training session. You will get that invitation to the training session as part of the Part 1 notification as well. And for the bid form, we will provide a guide for completing, encrypting, and submitting the bid form through the secure bid transfer site. Finally, we'll provide confidential information, including a username and password to access the secure bid transfer site, and a security code that's going to be unique to you, to the bidder, and that will allow us to authenticate that the bid form is yours. If you are successful in the Part 1 proposal, then you're invited to submit the Part 2 proposal, which officially, strictly speaking, is in two packages. One of the packages is in the bids that are going to be submitted on the bid date, and the other package is the response to all the other requirements of the Part 2 proposal. And that include the bid assurance collateral that we were mentioning a minute ago. It will also include evidence that the applications for all non-ministerial permits have been submitted or are in hand. So I mentioned that you're going to be listing those non-ministerial permits in Part 1 and providing evidence that you've submitted your application to obtain those permits in the Part 2 proposal. You'll provide fill in a number of fields to provide information throughout the online Part 2 form, including confirmation of contact information that you have provided in the Part 1 form. You will be submitting marketing materials that you have used or are planning to use to promote the project or to promote participation in the IPA program. You'll also make a number of additional representations or certification, including your commitment to abide by the requirements of the REC contract. In terms of the amounts for the bid assurance collateral and the form of the bid assurance collateral, so with respect to the form, you can submit bid assurance collateral either in the form of cash or in the form of a pre-bid letter of credit. The bid assurance collateral must be provided to each company separately, meaning a certain amount provided to AIC and a certain amount provided to ComEd, and the amounts are given here per project. So $10,000 for AIC per project and $20,000 to ComEd per project. If you're presenting proposals for multiple projects, you have the option of providing a single letter of credit or effecting a single wire transfer to a given company for the amounts required for all projects, and we'll provide more precise instructions in terms of wire transfers and the addresses for the companies and so forth for the submission of bid assurance collateral with the Part 1 notification, or you can request those instructions to be provided to you earlier, but first you'll have to submit the Part 1 proposal to get access to those instructions. In terms of additional requirements or things to keep in mind for the bid assurance collateral, so if it's the pre-bid letter of credit that you're using for a given company, so for either AIC or ComEd, then that pre-bid letter of credit must be either in the standard form, and we will be posting the standard form for each company on the procurement website, or that pre-bid letter of credit can only incorporate those modifications that are acceptable to the company and posted to the procurement website. And that's where it becomes important to submit any modifications that you may need in the Part 1 proposal. For cash, you'll be required to provide additional documents if you want to submit bid assurance in cash, including a cash insert for each company that will detail the condition under which the cash can be drawn, and then documents for the entity to which the cash will be returned at the end of the procurement event. And that will include a W-9 form for the entity to which cash will be returned and a draft request for the return of cash. And we have standard forms that you can use for that purpose. I'll talk a little bit more about bids and the bid form and the post-bid process in this next section. Just a reminder that we'll be providing a bid form in Excel format, and that's really the exclusive method that you must use for the submission of bids. We'll be providing that customized bid form for use of all of the projects that you qualify through a successful Part 1 proposal with the Part 1 notification. Once you have filled in that form, and we'll provide a guide to help you do that, then you will be submitting that bid form via a secure bid transfer site. Once the transfer is complete, then you phone us, the procurement administrator, to be able to confirm receipt of the form. And we'll either confirm receipt immediately, or if we're not in receipt of the form and there might be technical difficulties, then you may want to resort to the backup method, which is to submit your bid form via email. The bid window during which you will be transferring that bid form through the secure bid transfer site is between 10 a.m. and noon on the bid date of December 13, all times being central prevailing time. And there is then a cure deficiency period. So although we'll be acknowledging right away whether we received your bid form or not, after we finish making that acknowledgement, we will be evaluating the bid forms. And once we've evaluated the bid forms, we may phone you back if we see that there is missing information or information that's inconsistent in the bid form. And if there are those kinds of deficiencies, you will have an opportunity to cure. And your opportunity to cure is during the cure deficiency period from noon to 1 p.m. on the bid date. So you have to be available during the cure deficiency period in case you are required to resubmit your bid form in order for your bids to be evaluated. So a bid is a price per rec, and that would be the price paid should your project be selected and approved by the commission for each rec that's delivered and attributable to subscribed shares. With that bid, you will also be required to provide a minimum size, and that's a minimum nameplate capacity in kilowatts AC rating, and that's the minimum that the seller would accept. So the circumstances where that might happen is if, given the target for the number of RECs in this procurement event, a project could be selected but not for the full expected output from that project using the standard capacity factor. So in that case, if you provide a minimum size, and the minimum size can be the number of RECs that corresponds to that minimum size can be accommodated underneath the target, then your project would be selected. Otherwise, the projects are selected strictly on the basis of price. There will be an appendix to the RFP rules that will be posted to the procurement website that will provide additional detail regarding the evaluation and some examples. The procurement administrator expects to notify bidders on the bid date by 6 p.m., whether they have one or more projects with bids that will be identified as winning bids to the Illinois Commerce Commission. We make that notification earlier to the extent we can, and we may make it later to the extent that circumstances warrant. If it's not already done, then if you have a project that has bids that's identified as a winning bid to the commission, then you will have to provide information for preparation of the REC contracts with the company. So you will have the option to provide that information earlier in the Part 2 proposal. To the extent that you chose not to provide that information at that time, you will be required to provide the information for preparation of the REC contract, which is through an insert, by noon on the day after you're notified that you have a project that's been selected and that is being identified as a winning bid to the Illinois Commerce Commission. Within 2 business days of the bid date, each of the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor submits a confidential report to the Illinois Commerce Commission regarding the results of the procurement event. And then within 2 business days of receipt of those reports, the Illinois Commerce Commission decides whether or not to accept the results of the procurement event. So assuming that the commission does accept the results of the procurement event, then the next step is the execution of the contract and the payments of various fees. So each company at that point would send electronically to the seller partially executed contract documents, and the seller would then countersign and send back those contract documents electronically. That occurs within 3 business days of the commission decision on the results of the procurement event. Within 7 business days of approval of the results by the commission, then the payments of supplier fees are due. Finally, within 30 business days of approval of the results by the commission, then performance assurance under the terms of the REC contract is due. And with that, I will turn it back over to Mr. Benjamin Chi to walk us through the details of the supplier contract. Mr. Chi.
Thank you, Dr. Lacasse, and for walking us through the requirements of the RFP process. Here on this next couple of slides, we're going to cover what we are after in terms of the transaction details and what the delivery requirements look like. So I'll start us off here with some of the contract basics. So the contract is a contract that must be awarded through the RFP. It is not a contract for your project. We call it a REC contract because it is a contract for RECs from your project. The counterparties are going to be either Ameren Illinois or the Commonwealth Edison Company, and the REC contract is entered for the project with ComEd or AIC or both. And again, the REC contract is for payment of RECs only, and there will be no payment for energy or capacity or for your installation. In terms of the structure, I'll just note that this is a long-form agreement, and the REC contract will include a cover sheet up front and a bunch of exhibits after that. I'll explain a little bit about what the exhibits are doing and what they are for. But the two things that you should know is that there is something called an Exhibit J, which is the Master REC Agreement, which is based off of a standard ABA EMAA called Master REC Agreement. And the terms of the Master REC Agreement will govern unless it is modified in the cover sheet. I will talk about the cover sheet and how it interacts in the next slide. But here on this slide, the other exhibits tied to the cover sheet itself or the REC contract itself after the cover sheet is Exhibit A that contains reports that the IPA will complete and provide to both buyer and seller, buyer either ComEd or AIC and seller, that's you, under the contract. And the project status reports will give a very quick snapshot of where the project is in terms of the development stage, where it's at, as well as the pricing information will be there, and the size information of the project will be there. So it's a really a snapshot summary of the projects that will put both parties, the buyer and the seller, on the same page. Exhibit B and Exhibit C and D are items that must be provided by you during the term of the contract. So I'll start off with Exhibit B. You will soon learn that the REC contract itself envisage two phases, a development phase and a delivery phase. In terms of the development phase, you sign the contract and you're in the building phase of your contract, has not been energized, then you must provide a biannual system status form to the IPA and to buyer every 6 months to tell us that the project is being developed, you don't see any impediments, it's on schedule, and it will be built. So that's what the biannual system status form is about. Once it is energized, then the IPA will provide one of the Exhibit A reports to confirm that for both buyer and seller, and after which the first year of operation will have a report known as the first year report to be provided by you. That's Exhibit C. The first year report has a few pieces of information that will be important, including information about the subscription rates, the project, and how it is currently or at that point in time being subscribed by subscribers, and the status and the progress of that. And each delivery year, and I'll talk about what a delivery year is under the contract, you will have to submit each July 15 something known as a REC annual report. And that REC annual report will include information about the development of your project if it has not been energized, as well as information about the REC deliveries and subscription, so that we can look back into the delivery year that has just concluded to see how the project is performing. There will also be other items tied to this. I will talk about Exhibit I first. Exhibit I is a project subscription information access authorization that you must provide to your subscribers for them to execute and return back for purposes under this contract, so that we understand and we know that we have access to certain subscriber information. Other things that are in the contract, it will include forms of a letter of credit that you can use. There are two forms that you can use to comply with the credit requirements or the performance assurance requirements under the contract. And there will be this concept known as a true-up payment amount or a true-up payment adjustment. We have provided an example of that in Exhibit H. And so that you are aware, if you have not gone there yet, on the procurement website, the REC contract has already been posted and you can find the actual contract itself online. So on this slide, slide 44, I will very quickly cover about here about the interaction between the cover sheet and the Master REC Agreement. So the Master REC Agreement itself is a standard agreement issued by the ABA, EMA, ACOR, that provides a purchase and sale agreement for RECs. Exhibit J will govern unless it is modified by the terms in the cover sheet. The cover sheet itself is in the front part of the agreement. The cover sheet is what we also call the main body of the contract. It contains many of the terms that are specific to this procurement event, including the project requirements, invoicing and payment requirements, delivery requirements, development requirements, as well as triggers for event of default, for non-performance, for non-compliance, and the penalties associated with them. The cover sheet itself also introduces new definitions as well as replace existing provisions or definitions found in the Master REC Agreement. So you should take a look at the REC contract itself, which contains the cover sheet and a bunch of exhibits at the end. I will start with the cover sheet so that you understand where things are, and more particularly, I will start with the definitions that are found in the back end of the cover sheet letter part, so that at least you will have some of the definitions in mind as you review the main body of the contract as well as Exhibit J. In terms of time elements, there are three time elements envisaged in the contract. I will talk about them here. You should know that there is these three time elements. We'll start with the delivery year. A delivery year basically differs from a calendar year in that it runs from June 1st of a year through May 31st of the following year. There are certain things that we do on a delivery year basis, the most obvious of which is the submission of your REC annual report. They are due after the conclusion of a delivery year. After a delivery year ends on May 31st, you must submit your REC annual report to the IPA by July 15th. And then there's going to be a performance review of your system, of your REC deliveries, of your subscription by the IPA so that they know how to calculate the true-up payment adjustments. That is done based on the REC annual report that you provide, and it is a true-up that is being calculated for the delivery year that has just concluded. So this is how we're going to use the term delivery year, and these are some of the things that will flow from that, a delivery year. Delivery year, again, runs June through May, and it is starting from the effective date of the contract through the term of the contract. And then within that, there is something known as a delivery term. A delivery term is a very specific term that is defined in the contract, and delivery term commences on the first day of the month in which you initiate your first REC delivery, and it will end 180 months thereafter on the last day of the month, basically allowing you 15 years of REC delivery. And then we have quarterly periods. A few things are done on a quarterly basis. The quarterly period are the three-month period within a delivery year, starting with June through August. We have then September through November, December through February, ending with March through May. Those are what we define as quarterly periods. The thing that would be most relevant to you is that REC deliveries are accounted for on a quarterly period basis, and then the invoicing and payment obligations occur on a quarterly basis. Once a quarter has concluded, you will proceed to invoice and get paid for your REC deliveries for the quarter that has just concluded. So this is how it works. Payments are done on a quarterly basis, but you have a true-up that occurs on an annual basis, more to the point on a delivery year basis. At the core of community renewable projects is the concept of a subscriber. So subscriber are going to be customers that have subscribed shares to the project. And the way that we are defining subscribed shares are really subscribers having subscribed shares on a KW basis, and subscription is going to be a share of the actual nameplate capacity in as a percent of that KW. So a customer that is a subscriber must be a customer in the interconnecting utilities service territory. It may not be the counterparty of the contract, just take note, but wherever the location of the project is located, wherever the project itself is residing, the service territory of the interconnecting utility must be where the customer sits and is taking service. The other thing to note is that the customer itself must be receiving net metering, and no single subscriber may constitute more than 40% of the actual nameplate capacity. So here in a nutshell is just a visual on how the contract will unfold. So once you sign the contract on the effective date, you have been declared a winner in the procurement event, and the ICC has approved the results, then you proceed to build your renewable project, and you will have 18 months to do that. Extensions will be granted under certain circumstances, and then you will let the IPA know once your project is up and running. It has to be registered with GETS and MRETS, and there are two very critical elements to energization. The first is that at least 50% of the actual nameplate capacity of the project must be subscribed at that point in time for it to be considered energized. And the second is that you must establish a standing order with either GETS or MRETS for your system to be considered energized. The setting up of a standing order basically sets up an agreement with the tracking system for the automatic transfer of your RECs. The REC, once it is transferred, the first REC delivery, once it has occurred, will trigger the delivery term, and the delivery term will run 15 years out from that point in time. So we are contemplating, after energization, 15 years of delivery under this REC contract. I'll flag one thing for you here. Maybe I'll flag two things for you here. First is that under this REC contract, all RECs that are transferred under the standing order belongs to the utility. Anything that is not transferred because it is not transferred by the standing order belongs to you as the seller. You can deal with those RECs however you want. And the second thing to note is that payment under this REC contract is for eligible RECs. There are two components to eligible RECs. Eligible RECs are RECs that are being transferred or delivered and that are attributable to subscribed shares of the project. Just keep in mind these two elements. I will go through a couple of slides that try to explain and try to fix some ideas, but these two concepts are very key to your understanding of how you're going to get paid. Again, the two elements are that in order to get paid for those RECs, it has to be delivered and it has to be attributable to subscribed shares. The RECs that you transfer, once it is transferred, will always belong to the utility, and they will not be returned back to you, whether they are eligible or not. So on to the next slide. Here, the standing order, again, is for the automatic transfer of RECs. Initially, when you sign the contract and you energize the project, the standing order will be set at 100%. That means that 100% of all the RECs and all the output from the project, in terms of the RECs that are issued, will be transferred to the utility's account. It's an automatic transfer once you set up and it's been accepted as a standing order. There's nothing you need to do as a seller. The tracking system, either GETS or MRETS, will take care of the delivery of RECs automatically. The slide here shows that upon energization, the standing order is going to be set at 100%. All of the RECs are going to be transferred from your project, but there is a reset period. So after the first year of operations, and in this case, you will have to submit to the IPA what we call a first year report that will provide subscription information for the quarters that have just passed. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the actual average subscription as a share of your actual nameplate capacity to see what the actual subscription percentage is for each of the quarters that have occurred in the first year of operation. We're going to pick the highest, and we're going to call that the base subscription rate. You can always request for a higher rate if you want, but the base subscription rate by default is going to be the highest of the average subscription percentage that has been observed in the first four quarterly periods, including a stop period if it doesn't start neatly on a quarter. And the base subscription rate, whether it's something that is the default or something that is requested by you, cannot be less than 50%. And it will be used to reset the standing order at that point. Once it is reset, what it means is that you cannot no longer deliver those racks to the buyer. It is going to be set, in this case, at 70%, because that's the highest observed subscription rate throughout this first year period. And once we set it at 70%, means that going forward throughout the remainder of the delivery term, we're going to get only 70% of the racks from your project on a recurring basis. The other 30% belongs to you. You can do whatever you want with those racks that are not being delivered to buyer. You'll not get paid for them. They are your property to be used by you. So, on to this slide 49, the key thing here to note is that there's going to be a true-up adjustment. Again, I mentioned a few slides ago, payment for your racks are really for racks that are A, being delivered by you through a standing order, and B, that are attributable to subscribed shares of the project. I raise this here because this is central to how the true-up adjustment works. So this contract features a paid-as-delivered feature or element, and it is subject to an annual true-up. What it means is that we're going to pay you along the way on a quarterly basis, and then we're going to make a true-up adjustment once a year based on the actual subscription. So at the end of the day, payment will only be made for racks that are delivered and that are attributable to subscribed shares. So as you deliver your racks each quarter, you invoice the buyer each quarter and get paid for all of the delivered racks initially. And then once a year, you will have to provide a rack annual report that provides average subscription information. With that, we will calculate a true-up payment amount, and then we will true-up your contract payments in the future against future payments. And the true-up amount basically nets out or take back the money that was prepaid to you that we have later estimated or determined to be for attributable to unsubscribed shares or not attributed to subscribed shares of the project. If this sounds complicated to you, do not worry. Take a look at Exhibit H of the REC contract. There is a fairly detailed example that is provided. There are a couple pages to that. If you walk through the example carefully, it's very intuitive what's going on there. Over on to slide 50 here, we sort of flesh out some of the concepts here a little bit more. In the next three slides, you will see different scenarios of how the true-up payment works. So here, assuming that you have rack deliveries in this, starting with June 1st, you'll find here on the four bars at the top, you have the delivered racks. Given that the standing order is set at 100%, means all of the racks on your project are being delivered to buyer. And the racks that are delivered accounted for each quarter. For June through August, you have 100 racks that are delivered and paid for. You have 90 racks for the following quarter of September through November that are being delivered and paid for. December through February, you have 95 racks that are delivered and paid for. And in March and April, you have 105 racks that are delivered and paid for. At the end of this delivery year, you submit to the IPA a rack annual report. We looked at the report and we determined something known as a delivery year average subscription rate from your rack annual report. That basically is the average subscription rate that is observed for the delivery year that has just passed. And in this example, we looked and we say the average subscription rate is 60%. Only 60% of your project is being subscribed, even though you have delivered 100% and the standing order is set at 100%. So for this, the total number of RECs that have been paid is 390 RECs. The total eligible RECs, which is just 60% of whatever that is produced from the system, is 234 RECs. What it means is that you have delivered 156 RECs for which we have already paid you, but they are ineligible, meaning that they are tied to unsubscribed portions of the project. They are not tied to subscribed shares. And there we will calculate a true-up amount, basically taking the REC price or your bid price of $20, multiply the 156 RECs to get you to a true-up amount of $3,120 that will be netted against your following quarter's invoice. So whenever we do this calculation, you will have future payments or invoices coming in. We will just net it out and true up the payment and adjust it that way. In terms of the various scenarios here, we have a subsequent delivery year where the base subscription rate is brought down to 60%. So that's how I'm going to set up this example on slide 51. And because the standing order is set at 60% based on the base subscription rate that is determined, what is being delivered can only be representing 60% of the total RECs that were issued for the project. In this case, 60 RECs for the first quarter, 66 RECs for the second, 54 RECs for the third, and 72 RECs for the last quarter in this delivery year. That brings you to a total of 252 RECs that have been delivered and paid for. At the end of this delivery year, we look and we say, you know, in your REC annual report, your average subscription rate is only 50%. So what we will do then is we take 50% of your project's output of the entire project's RECs that were issued, and that becomes what we deem as eligible RECs. With that, what it means also is that there is at least 10% of the output from the project that are ineligible. In this case, 210 RECs are deemed to be eligible RECs, and 42 RECs are deemed to be ineligible RECs. So we're going to perform a true-up adjustment, and the true-up amount is basically taking the $20 per REC times the 42 ineligible RECs that we have already paid you for previously, coming up to a true-up amount of $840 that will be trued up in the next payment that is to be made. Here we have a flip side of what happens when the average subscription rate, as observed after the conclusion of a delivery year, actually exceeds the base subscription rate. So in this case, we'll start with what is delivered. So delivered is the bars that are shaded in solid green here, 60 RECs for the first quarter, 66 RECs for the second, 54 RECs for the third, and 72 RECs for the last quarter in this delivery year. This is based on you setting the standing order at 60%, which is what we call the base subscription rate. So again, once you set the base subscription rate and it is established in the standing order, that is the amount of RECs from the system that gets to get transferred from GETS or MRETS into the buyer's account. You cannot deliver more, you cannot deliver less. This is exactly the amount that is being delivered automatically from your tracking system for your project into the buyer's account. At the end of this delivery year, we look and we received your annual report, and in that we determined that the delivery year average subscription rate is 70%, which is above the base and above the standing order, and in this case, what we will look at really is to say, you know, we have paid you for 252 racks in all, corresponding to all of the racks that you have delivered to us. While the subscriptions are higher, we did not receive those racks from you. And therefore, the total ineligible racks are really zero racks that have been paid out to you that we need to claw back. So there's no true up needed in this case. What do you do with the racks that are attributable to subscribe shares that are in excess of the base subscription? They belong to you. They're not transferred to us. They belong to you. You can deal with it however you want. You're not going to be paid for them, and you are not going to deliver them to us. So that's how it will work. They are your property. And again, bringing back the concept that the RECs that are eligible for payment must have two components. One, they must be delivered. They must be attributable to subscribe shares of the project. With that, I will talk a little bit about the collateral requirement and the maximum contract value. So as I said, quarterly basis, you will see the invoicing and payment obligations. And here we bring home a few elements related to the contract value. There's going to be a contract value that is set based on the size of the project and the standard capacity factor. This is the maximum amount of money that can be paid to you under the REC contract. And the annual contract value is taking the maximum contract value divided by 15, and that's the amount, the annual contract value is the amount of money that can be paid in a delivery year, or rather, that can be paid out for eligible RECs that are delivered in a delivery year. So these are the two constraints that binds how much the company can pay you throughout the term of the contract and throughout the delivery year. The collateral requirement, also synonymous with seller's performance assurance, is held by buyer, and that is just the value of the annual contract value. You must provide this in the form of a letter of credit or cash within 30 business days of the contract effective date, and it will be returned back to you only at the end of the contract term. And with that, I will end the presentation portion of this webcast.